You are listening to the award-winning Uncapped Podcast. Hey everyone, I'm your host Chris Sands, and today I am joined by Josh Cross, the beverage director at White Oak Tavern. Thank you for joining us again.
Absolutely.
Last time we focused on old fashions, but now you want to talk about martinis. And I realized that it was probably because there's the whole growing movement of the renaissance of martinis now. Because I think it was maybe the week after you suggested that to me, I got in some, I think it was like multiple newsletters where there were articles about the resurgence of martinis.
Yeah, I mean, I think in like the 15 years I've bartended, I haven't seen as much demand for it as I do now. And it keeps getting, you know, more and more popular. And kind of like as much as like we saw like the old fashioned for like maybe the last decade or so, I feel like it's kind of the new it drink.
Do you think that was kind of like because espresso martinis had a huge resurgence in popularity that kind of transitioned into all forms of martinis, or is there something else driving it?
I think like the espresso martini thing is just kind of like runs parallel to it and is kind of its own thing.
Okay.
And it's its own unique monster. Like every Saturday night, like, you know, we'll have, I don't know, a party like 10 or 12 people, and like after the entrees are done, like I'll just look at my ticket printer. I'm like, I'm about to get 10 espresso martinis. And
I still don't think I've ever had an espresso martini.
You know, it's, I think I talked about this on the last podcast, but where like I have this kind of like, if you can't beat them, join them ethos. So with espresso martinis, I think it was like when I was at Thatcher and Rye, we opened in the pandemic. Before that, I'd never really made a lot of them, like espresso martinis, like back when I was bartending at Family Meal. We'd get like the occasional one, but like maybe it was a product of like the pandemic or something. But as soon as Thatcher and Rye opened up, we started making them all the time. And I was like, I'd never really had like a recipe I liked for it. I never really kind of played around with it. And it was at Thatcher that I kind of developed two different recipes for espresso martinis. And I took it really seriously and I experimented with different coffee liqueurs. And so, yeah, I have a recipe for one with cream and one without cream that has like a little bit of vanilla liqueur. And, you know, the same thing with like other like quote unquote teenies. So like when White Oak opened, all of a sudden it was kind of the same thing, but with lemon drop martinis and French martinis. Lemon drop martinis I'd make occasionally, but now I make them all the time. French martinis, I had to look it up because I don't think anyone had asked me for one ever. So it's,
I guess let's start with at the base of what is a martini.
I mean, the history of it is like so convoluted. It's not really like the old fashioned where
you can trace it back.
Yeah, I mean, the old fashioned was like the like cocktail where, you know, the definition of a cocktail of like spirits, bitters, sugar, that is an old fashioned. But the martini like underwent so much change from like the late 19th century until like, let's say like the 1960s, that it started off as one thing that you wouldn't even recognize as a martini today into something that's like what we would recognize it to be. So like the first mention was in like 1888, but it was like equal parts Old Tom gin, which is, they still make it now, but it's a sweeter style of gin that's less juniper forward, and equal parts probably sweet vermouth. So the drink was like, didn't look anything like it does today. It was probably pretty sweet. And like vermouth back at that point, like sweet vermouth was a lot lighter than it is today. They didn't add caramel. Dry vermouth was a lot darker. And a lot of the martinis people were drinking were probably like kind of amber colored until the 30s. And then around that point, vermouth producers started filtering the color out of their martinis. But yeah, I mean, it really started off as a drink that was super popular, but no one really knew. There were like so many different varying recipes. And it wasn't really until like the 30s and 40s that like dry martinis started to become a thing.
Is that when olives were introduced, or was that early on?
Like back in like the early 20th century, like it kind of like fell into two camps. Like dry martinis would have dry vermouth and you would use twists or olives, and then people would still call for sweet martinis, and usually those be garnished with cherries.
Okay. I don't think I've only ever had one martini, and it was, I guess, that what is the Y Oak?
The Y Oak martini is just kind of like our signature martini, which pretty much lends itself to like a represent, like a, you know, like a classic martini.
Okay.
And you get to choose either gin or vodka, little vermouth, orange bitters, and then we kind of do both the lemon twist on the glass itself, and in that like sidecar we'll have Castle Vetrano olives.
So that would be a dry, more of martini.
It's definitely on the dry side. And, you know, I mean, that whole sort of march from the inception of the martini as this like kind of sweet drink, eventually by like the 1950s, 1960s, that was when you saw things getting like bone dry, and people were like, you had the In-N-Out method that people still ask for, where they're like, oh, just put a little vermouth in it, swirl it in and dump it out. And like, there were all these different gadgets in the 50s for like literally putting as little vermouth into a drink as possible. Like they'd sell martini kits for like home bartending, and they'd have like atomizers or like spritzers. You could just spritz the glass. I think they even sold like a silver plated needle that you could just measure out in cc's how much dry vermouth was in there.
At that point, just wanted to just drink straight gin.
Yeah. I mean, I there was like one quote, I can't remember what, where it was like some guy who's just, he was confused by the whole less and less vermouth thing. He's like, it's going to just end up where gin drinking began, which is just drinking gin. Yeah.
I like the presentation of the martinis at Y Oak also. Is that a normal way, or is that kind of like the deconstruction like kind of feel of all the like the meals are also?
It's kind of one of those things where like we had seen stuff like that being done at other restaurants. I think one bar in New York City that Brian pointed out to me was doing something similar. And I think for us, it's just kind of trying to like elevate the experience in a functional way. So that little like sidecar carafe on the crushed ice is there so that like by the time you are refilling your glass, you know, it's also cold. So if we served it in a larger glass, like a bigger coupe instead of the smaller Nicanora we do, it would fit the whole drink, but by the time you were halfway through, that it would warmed up a lot.
And you'd be stuck drinking out of a coupe, which I contend is the worst glass ever.
No, I contend the V-shaped martini glass is the worst, even though it's so deeply associated with martinis.
I mean, they're both awful, but I mean, really, both of them, you look at them and you spill something. I don't know who decided that we should make glassware that's almost impossible to drink out of.
Yeah, I don't know. But the V-shaped martini glass is the worst. And I'll even have like older guests who'll be like, well, it's not a martini if it's not in a martini glass. But I mean, even that, the glass has like a convoluted history too. Like the design probably originated in like, you know, the 1920s of the whole Art Deco thing. But then also is associated with these neon signs that, like, I guess they started using neon and signs for advertising in the 20s. And there's like one company that just made the iconic like tilted V-shaped glass with like an olive in it. And everyone used that for their bar. And that also like played along with the association. And then by like the 50s and 60s, like that's when you really saw that glass be associated with. Before that, like, there was no like set glass for a martini. Like
just whatever.
It could be like coupes or like wine glasses or like who knows what. But
does the, how important is the shape of the glass to a cocktail?
I mean, when you're serving something up, it's kind of the same idea as like a wine glass where you're able to hold onto the stem so that, you know, your hand's not on the bowl of the glass and warming it up.
Okay. The, cause definitely in beer, it makes a big difference on the shape, but I feel like there's less, kind of less aroma.
Yeah. I mean, do with, you know, we definitely like play around with that. Like the tuxedo martini that we do, like we give that both a spritz of absinthe and we express grapefruit oil on it. So that one's like super aromatic.
I got to try that one. That sounds really good.
Yeah, we sell a lot of that one. I think we have four or five on the menu currently.
So is that, I'm assuming since the one of the martinis bears the name of the restaurant, that like that is kind of what the marquee cocktail for Wyoke is, or is...
I mean, I think the fun thing about that one is that lately I've been using, especially with like the gin option on that, to kind of highlight different gins that I really like, and I'll kind of switch it up here and there. We opened the restaurant with Old Raj Blue Label Gin, which is made in Scotland, and it has saffron added to it. So it has this like little subtle yellow hue to it. And that one was really fun. And we've also done Sipsmith London Dry, which I like. And now I've started using Reisetbauer Blue Gin. It's not blue, it's clear, but it's made in Austria.
Blatant false advertisement.
Well, I mean, the guy who makes it's amazing. His name's Hans Reisetbauer, and he makes like some of the best like eau de vies in the world. And this is his gin, and it's delicious, and it works great with it. And also, like, I'll play around with the vermouth that we're using in it too. We used Gonzales Bias Extra Secco for a little while, which is a dry vermouth with a sherry base. And then now we're using Martini and Rossi Ambrato, which is kind of based on like historical styles of vermouth. So it's got like a little bit of a pale yellow color to it, and a little goes a long way. So we don't have to add a whole lot to it when we're making that cocktail.
How do you stay up to date on what the trends for cocktails are? Is it just based on like what people are coming in and asking for, or is there?
I mean, there's a difference between like what the majority of people are into and what like the cocktail nerds are into. So it's
sounds
kind of
very similar to beer.
Yeah. So
there's the, like what everyone like, actually is drinking. And then,
the guy's like, I want to make a Rausch beer. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I'll pay attention to like what's kind of like nationally trendy in like big cities, and then I'll also kind of take feedback from guests and see what's popular around town. And you know, I'm not the kind of person where like I'm gonna make something like really obtuse and weird and try and shove it down someone's throat. Like I want drinks that are, you know, delicious first and, you know, interesting second.
So you want the business to be successful?
Yeah. I mean,
I think there are too many people though that will go the route of like just like trying to show off or something and not think about how like first and foremost you really should just make what people want to drink and sell them.
I mean, even with like the espresso martinis, I mean, we have a drink on the menu that's basically like my twist on an espresso martini. There's a lot of work that goes into it. I mean, we're fat washing tequila with coconut oil and like adding a little bit of salt and tiny bit of chili liqueur and banana liqueur, fresh espresso oh liqueur. And yeah, I want that drink to be like delicious upon impact. And I know I'm putting a lot of thought and effort into it, but the main thing is that someone takes a sip and they're like, yeah, that's delicious.
Well, yeah, because if not, then you kind of just sure, you put a lot of work into it, but really you just wasted your time. Yeah, I mean, if people aren't drinking.
That doesn't mean I don't want to do like weird stuff. Like yeah. I have this idea now where there's this gin that I just tried from Citadel, so like a French gin company, and they do this gin that's infused with cantaloupe and citrus. And I was like, well, what if I render some prosciutto fat and we make a like prosciutto-y melon like gin? I don't know. Maybe it'll work. We can have a prosciutto and melon martini.
That'd be a lot of flavor.
But yeah, I mean, sometimes like people really are into weird ideas. Like I think the martini that we've gotten the most like press on and kind of the most questions about is the Mirepoix martini. So that's like a carrot, onion, and celery themed cocktail. So like Mirepoix is like a mix of those three vegetables used for like cooking purposes, okay. like stocks and sauces and all that. And it was like an idea I had for like years. And then finally this time I was like, all right, I got to make it work. So we do like, vodka that we sous vide with carrots, celery bitters, like dry vermouth, a little bit of gin, a little bit of onion brine. And then we'll like house pickle carrots, onion, and celery and do cocktail onions as like the garnish for that one.
I should have spent more time like actually looking at the menu because I didn't look at all. I just ordered an old fashioned because I knew that's what I would definitely enjoy.
Did you notice that I started putting cherries on them?
I did notice
just,
that.
Just for you.
I'm not going to believe that, but I'll say thank you anyway.
I mean, I think it was like just part of like the trying to just fit the vibe of like a steakhouse. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like if I walked into like, you know, like a famous steakhouse, they'd probably put a cherry on the old fashioned or.
Well, yeah, definitely. And most like the, pretty much everywhere that made a really good one in Frederick too also added one.
Yeah, I finally caved. I don't like it.
But
I don't like it, but I think it looks good. And it does look people good, like it.
And I love a good cherry. There are plenty of people that don't like them though. But if you don't like it, then you just
I think less than do though. Because I think I've maybe had like three instances where someone's been like, oh, don't hold the cherry.
Yeah, those people are wrong because Luxardo cherries are delicious.
They're good. My dad really likes them, and he's like, "Do you know these are like $23 for a little jar?" I'm like, "Yeah."
I almost bought one of the. I can't remember what the size is, but of like the huge can.
Oh, the can. Yeah, we buy like six huge cans at a time.
Yeah, well, it makes sense for a business, but
yeah, but then you look at the invoice and you're like, oh.
Yeah, it was, well, I did the math and it's substantially cheaper to get them that way. But then I was like, but then I also have like probably 2 years worth of cherries, but I don't think they ever go bad, right?
Not really. You also shouldn't put them in your fridge.
Thankfully, some stroke of luck, I actually read the bottle and saw that because I definitely would have put it into the refrigerator.
Yeah, the like syrup will start like crystallizing.
And I also like putting a little cocktail spoon of the syrup in my drink.
Of course you do.
But it's delicious. So have martinis taken over as like the number one cocktails you sell, or is it still?
We still sell a ton of old fashions, and unlike Thatcher and Rye, like I don't list it on the menu. And you know, when we were all talking about like what we wanted the beverage program to look like, you know, my big thing was like drinks wise, when I think of a steakhouse, I think of like really big red wine, like Napa Cab. I think about, you know, really big cold martinis. So that's why, you know, we're basically serving like a martini and a half with a martini service. And then, you know, I think of, you know, dark spirits, you know, bourbons, ryes, scotches. And I think we have a really great selection. And just because we're in a hotel and we have clientele kind of from all around the area, I'm able to like buy some things that I might not have been, it might have been a harder sell at Thatcher. Like we bought a bottle of Michter's 20 year that we only have one pour left, and it's like $200 a pour.
Holy cow.
And I'm like, Oh, we did it.
But it's kind of like I'm just speculating because I've never worked at a hotel, but I would think like the clientele in a hotel hosted restaurant, it's kind of a different, you're much more likely to treat yourself.
Like yeah.
And
the environment's really special. So. Yeah.
So there's people are probably more likely to splurge because it's not like it's any more of a higher end restaurant than Thatcher and Rye was. It's pretty on par from the, like what you would consider what it was.
But I do think that we're still trying to like elevate the experience even more. And just that setting is gorgeous in there. And yeah, you sit down at that bar and ceilings are so high and you think, oh, why not treat myself to a pour of Michter's 20 year?
And it's beautiful in there.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever had the 20 year. I've had the next one down.
The 10 year.
Yeah. It was really good.
The 20 year was, I was surprised we were able to get a bottle, but you know, I asked and I was like, can I buy this? And they were like, go for it, but you got to sell it.
How much is a bottle of that?
Like our cost? It was a lot.
Yeah. I've just never looked at the,
but on the secondary market, like it'll go, you know, $2,500 to $3,000. Which is definitely like,
it's insane.
Way more than it would cost if it was priced reasonably. But
yeah,
you know, I mean, I that's like a bottle that's probably harder to get than like Pappy 23 or something.
Yeah, because those go for six, and or no, 20s go for like six, four to six, right?
I don't know. I've had all of them, and they're all good, but
they're not.
There's no bottle of whiskey that's worth like three grand or something.
The video that I made of making an old fashioned with Pappy 20 years just about to hit 600,000 views. And there's a lot of people who hated me for it. Then there's also like the people who like they're some sort of super detective declaring that it was fake or, well, and then there's also the people that are like that's not the right color. I can assure you it is absolutely the right color. It may not have been Pappy 20, but it matches it perfectly.
I was working at a whiskey bar in Baltimore that shut down during the pandemic, but I think we had like 400 or 500 whiskeys and we had Pappy 23, and I'm not making this up. There was one guy that came in and he ordered one with Diet Coke.
Nice.
We didn't care.
Can you sell it either way?
It was like $150 whiskey diet.
I would drink it. I want to find a bottle of 20 so I can make actually, because I only had a few ounces left in that bottle. So I did refill it with, I can't remember what I've refilled it with.
I think 15 is the best one. 20 is really good. 23 is over oaked.
Yeah,
but the 15's also like at 107 proof, so that's kind of like right in my wheelhouse of what I like proof wise.
Yeah, it's not like they're bad, but they're not anything I would pay the price for.
That's why like even though Scotch prices have gone up, like I'll splurge for like a Scotch that I can easily find that I think like more directly represents like a value than like a bourbon that's like super hard to get, that's jacked up in price just because it's hard to get. Like the Buffalo Trace stuff is like so irritating to me. Like, yes, I like their products, but like, you know, I think we sold like almost all but a pour of Eagle Rare in one night. Like the night that I put it on our menu, the Eagle Rare was essentially gone in one night.
Because Eagle Rare is legit. Like I like Eagle Rare way more than I like Pappy.
Oh, that's a hot take.
I mean, I would, I will say it again. I really like Eagle Rare. I don't like what people try to charge for. Although the secondary of that's gone way down with the supply, seems to be much better.
We don't get that much. You know how much like Wheatley vodka I have to sell just to like get a couple bottles a month, like. Just cases and cases. And then, like, I'll get my allocation. It's like, all right, you got one Blanton's, one E.H. Taylor. you got an Eagle Rare. And then we gave you three bottles of Buffalo Trace. And like, that's all going to be gone in a month. And I dole it out like one at a time. I was like, all right, we'll put the Eagle Ray up. They're going to kill it. And like, put the Blanton's up. That's going to be gone in 2 days too.
And also Blanton's is really good, but it's not worth what, like, it's,
well, the price has actually gone up on it. It's more available, but every time I see it in a liquor store, it's like $100, and I could get Knob Creek 12 year for like 60, and I like that better.
The MSRP though is still,
no, it's higher now.
Oh, is it?
Like, you know, I think 68 directly from the distributor. So,
okay. Huh. But at least it's like, I don't know, it's good. I'm not going to pay the price for it, but it's good.
But yeah, I mean, at White Oak, I do still have a lot of fun kind of like tracking down these limited or hard to get bottles and putting them on. And we have like a reserve whiskey list too, and our spirits list that's got some cool stuff on it.
Well, because I mean, it still gets people excited.
Yeah.
There's still plenty of people that are willing to pay whatever it takes to try something that they haven't been able to get themselves.
Yeah. I mean, that's like the Eagle Rare thing. You just don't really see that in a liquor store anymore. So you walk up and I get it. You're like, I haven't had that in 2 years because I haven't been able to find anywhere. So yeah. I really want that. I get it.
What other trends are you seeing in cocktails now?
I mean, dirty martinis are back with a vengeance too. I hate them, but
making them or just the taste
of them? I just I can't drink them. It's just like, you know, it's like boozy seawater.
It's like the Goza of the cocktail world.
I like Gozas though, but I've been like reluctant to do blue cheese olives up until this point too. And when Brian was like, you know, we're gonna like pretty much like be a steakhouse, I'm like, well, I'm gonna have to do blue cheese olives. I like olives, I love blue cheese. I do not like them when they're mixed together. And
I don't know if I ever have. I absolutely love olives, and I love mixed with things. I don't know if I've ever had a blue cheese one,
but yeah, I mean, they the blue cheese olive like originated in steakhouses. Like, it is okay. a steakhouse a thing. Like, it was like Chicago steakhouses in the 90s started doing it, and then kind of spread.
Where do you draw your inspiration when you're coming up with a new cocktail?
Sometimes it's like conceptual, so you're like, oh, I want to do like this twist on espresso martini, and I've had an espresso martini with tequila before, so we'll use that kind of as our jumping off point. Like, the jumping off point is tequila espresso martini. It's like, how can we make this more interesting? All right, let's fat wash the tequila with coconut oil. Let's add banana liqueur to it as well. And then let's kind of refine it until it's like ready to go on a menu. And then other times it'll just be like, I try a specific product and then kind of build the whole drink around it.
Okay. So just a spirit you try that you really usually, want to use this in something.
Usually like a liqueur or okay. like something like kind of oddball, like the garden martini on the menu. I tried, a basil eau de vie from St. George Spirits in California. And I was just like blown away by it. It's not like sweet, it's an eau de vie. So, but yeah, they use like Genovese and Thai basil. And I was like, I just want to build the whole thing around this. So, found a gin that worked for it, which happened to be McClintock Forager gin. Dry vermouth, the basil eau de vie. We used a little bit of this Greek liqueur called Mastia, which is made from like the resin of a tree bark. And then we add like black pepper tincture that I make. So it's got kind of like this like savory, salady, herbal vibe to it. And then it all just was based off of me trying one product and being like, that's cool. I want to make a drink like kind of centered around this one thing.
Have you had the cherry berry on a cloud at the back bar?
No, I haven't been in there in a while. Like, I hadn't noticed that they were changing their drink menu up very much, and I haven't been in, but
yeah, I think they do it seasonally, maybe, and maybe only spring and fall. But it's a newer drink. It's really good.
I'll have to try it.
I enjoy it. All right, so I just entered the ChatGPT prompt to give me a list of questions to ask a mixologist during a podcast interview. So I haven't read these yet. So we're going to see how good ChatGPT is at.
I've like tried to see how good ChatGPT is at actually coming up with cocktail recipes. Not that good. I think I'm safe for a little while.
And it's also horrendous for asking for like cookie recipes.
Too. Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It'll probably get better and better, but you know, all that thing does is just take all the information about cocktails on the internet and just cobble something together.
Yeah. So it's not gonna be innovative or
Yeah, I mean, it can't taste anything, though.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So if it's trying to come up with something new, like ChatGPT can't taste. So it doesn't know that it needs like two dashes of bitters instead of one.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't tried it for a cocktail recipe yet.
I just wanted to know how much longer I was going to have a job before the robots took over.
So you're safe for another couple years.
Yeah.
I guess we just asked you that. Just walk us through the process when creating a new cocktail. You kind of.
Yeah, I mean, there's a. Like, I'm pretty maniacal with it. Like, I don't stop until I'm, like, completely happy with something. So, you know, once all the ingredients are together and I've kind of written my first sketch of a recipe out, we'll try that. And then I'll be like, oh, this needs, like, more acid, or it needs more of one of this ingredient. So then we'll make it again. And then if that's not good, then I'll look at the recipe again. We're like, maybe we bump this up, take this down a little bit. Try it with this bitters, try it with this bitters. And I work with the sommelier a lot too, because his palate's amazing. Steve Zamuda at White Oak. And I think him coming from like the wine world, he has a lot of insight that I don't have, just because, like, you know, I have the cocktail and spirits background. He has the wine background. But yeah, I mean, he's offered me a lot of suggestions that I normally wouldn't think of, just because the way his taste works.
Do you consider yourself having a good palate?
Can you taste something
and be able to pick out?
Yeah, I mean, if I have a cocktail that's not balanced right, I know what's wrong with it. Like,
okay.
I know they didn't add enough sugar to it. If it's too sour, I can tell if it's, you know, they need to add more acid because it's too sweet. I can tell if they've thrown too many ingredients in there and I can't figure out what's going on. And it's what I would call like an illegible cocktail.
I do not have a good palate. I cannot do that.
I mean, you're the one that went around ranking the best old fashions in Frederick.
I did not rank them. If you reread that article, I described and I said what I liked about them. I can discern whether something is something I don't like or if it's made poorly. But like, if you give me something and ask me to pick out like the flavors I'm tasting, I'm horrible at that.
Yeah. And I don't judge anyone who doesn't spend that much time with it, which is, like I was saying earlier, the biggest thing I want out of people having my drinks is I just want them to be like, hey, that's delicious. I like that. If they want to get nerdy with me, I'll get nerdy with them. But like, you know, really, I just want them to be like, that's great. That's awesome. That's tasty.
Netza, I remember like from the second you told me that you used two different orange bitters brands because you liked aspects of each one.
Yeah, I mean, that's,
so then you mixed them.
That's kind of like a long-standing thing in bars that I didn't come up with, but
it just everyone was like detail that
everyone was like Fee Brothers bitters are like too juicy, Regan's orange bitters are a little too dry, and, you know, a little too much cardamom. So everyone just started calling it Fegans. Okay. And that's kind of become the de facto thing. But yeah, we blended that with the Angostura and a little bit of the other aromatic bitters.
Do you remember the first cocktail you ever made?
The first one I ever came up with? Yeah. I mean, I think it was good, but it was definitely like a first timer drink. It was at, I think it was a family meal in maybe 2013. And I think it had gin, watermelon, and mint in it. Like, you know, some lime juice, simple syrup, and a lot of muddling, which I hate muddling anything now. So
here,
I don't even remember what it was called.
What is the rule for, like, the different ways to prepare a cocktail, like shaking, stirring, or then like what type of shaker to use?
So, I mean, the basic rule of thumb is that, like, if your drink has juice, cream, or egg white or egg yolk in it, you're going to want to shake it to incorporate all the ingredients. And then on the flip side, if like all of your ingredients are, like spirit ingredients, so like straight liquors, like whiskey, rye, gin, tequila, whatever, like fortified wines, Amaros, all those like already alcoholic ingredients, you want to stir it for like a couple reasons. Like stirring something like a martini or Manhattan, you're going to get one, there's an aesthetic advantage to it. It's going to be crystal clear and it's not going to come out cloudy. And two, like it's a texture thing. Like when you shake something, you know, you kind of want that like effervescent, like almost bubbly, tingly quality to it. But with a stirred drink, you want it to be more silky and, yeah, I hate to use the word smooth, but, but yeah, that also goes back to martinis where it's like, I keep thinking to myself, like, nothing has done more harm to the martini than James Bond. Like, James Bond orders bad martinis. Like, he orders vodka martinis, for one, which I have a lot of opinions on. And he orders them shaken, not stirred. And, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I really think that it was just, like, yeah, the author of, like, James Bond, Ian Fleming, he was just, like, projecting his own drinking habits onto it. And like James Bond doesn't just drink martinis in the books. He drinks like everything. Like he's drinking all the time. I think there was like a study in the UK where these physicians like analyzed how much James Bond drank and they're like, he's a hopeless drunk who would die by 56. And that's how long Ian Fleming lived. He made it to 56.
So it checks out.
And then the other thing with shaking is like, I think part of the reason why people associate it so much with martinis, not just the James Bond thing, is like shaking is just like inherently more theatrical and fun to watch, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you see like a bartender, it's like, chick. And in movies, like that looks better in a scene with like a bartender than someone who's just swirling a spoon around a mixing glass. So. But stirring is better.
What's the proper name for the different types of shakers? Whereas like there's the two cups and then there's the one that has like it's shaped like an urn almost with a strainer at the top with a smaller lid. Do they have
I think that one's called a Parisian shaker, the one that's like got the built-in or a cobbler shaker, I think. Okay. Yeah, cobbler shaker is the one that's got the tiny little cap and then it's got like built-in holes to strain. Yeah. And you have, like, the Boston Shaker, which is, I think, one metal end and a pint glass, which, like, I hate that. It's, like, heavy as shit, and I don't know. I've seen bartenders, like, break the glass end of it before. But most, like, craft cocktail bars, they use, like, I guess you'd call it, like, tin-on-tin shakers.
Okay.
But, yeah, I don't know the actual name for that, but I just call it 10 on 10, where you have a small end and you have a larger end.
So is there functional differences between them that like you would want to use one over the other for different types of cocktails? Cause I think I learned the hard way one difference.
I would only ever use the 10 on 10 shakers. Okay. Specifically, we get they're called like Corico shakers from Cocktail Kingdom. That's the only one I would ever use.
Okay.
There's not advantages to any of the other ones, I don't think.
Well, I found a huge disadvantage of like the
little cobbler shaker.
The cobbler ones. Yeah. If you're muddling something, that's opening.
Oh,
the top,
yeah, it's just gonna get clogged with mint and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, all you really need at home is, you know, something to measure with. You should probably get a 10 on 10 shaker, and then, you know, for straining, you'd get what's called like a Hawthorne shake strainer, which is the one with the coil. And then I like to have like a mesh strainer as well, just to get all the little chunks of ice out. And then for stirred drinks, you just need some sort of mixing glass and a spoon. Some people use julep strainers, which look like a giant spoon with holes in it for stirred drinks, but I don't really think it's necessary. You can just use the same coiled Hawthorne strainer.
That's what I use, because I just bought a set of a glass with a Hawthorne strainer. No, I had only had a cobbler shaker because it's an insulated one.
Because
I was using it to make margaritas, but it's a really big one. So it's like I would just be able to make two at a time and keep one inside of the shaker.
I think my hands are just used to being like frozen cold all the time. Like there'll be like Friday, Saturday nights where I probably make like 200 drinks in a night.
Yeah, this wasn't like for protecting my. I got the insulated, not to protect my hands.
So you're like,
no, just so that it would.
I'm
keep
making
it.
So many, I don't want my hands to
no,
get cold.
No, because it would make two at a time. Big. It's like 20 some ounces.
The so ones we use, you can make two at a time. Like two is kind of like the max for the shakers we use.
So that way I could pour one, leave it sit in the shaker, and it would stay cold and not melt a lot because it was in the insulated.
I see.
So it was more of like a function of just wanting to drink outside and not have to run back in often to make.
Yeah, I have these like little Yeti tumblers where, like, you know, sometimes, like, you know, if I'm outside, I'll put like wine in it or maybe like a whiskey on the rocks. That thing stays cold
forever. Yep. So the
longer than it would take for me to ever drink anything.
I bought the shaker before because Yeti has a shaker attachment
now. Of course
now.
They do.
Yeah. Or you can buy like the whole shaker, or you can just get the top and it fits onto one of their models of water bottle. Or I probably would have got that. But the one I got, like, it's the same thing. It keeps it cold forever.
Yeah, it's great. If you ever seen like a show at Wolf Trap, you're allowed to.
I went there for the first time this past weekend.
You're allowed to bring your own booze and food. Like, my girlfriend and I will go and we'll bring like a charcuterie board and like wine, and then we'll like pour the wine into the Yeti cups and that'll stay cold the whole time.
Yeah, I didn't know that, or I would have brought my. Although you can, I don't think you can take your own stuff into the seats.
No,
area,
yeah.
Right?
If you're on the lawn, you can have yourself like a straight up picnic.
Yeah, like it's amazing. Looking around, like as we were walking up, I'm looking around and there's people like set up on blankets with coolers. And
it's amazing. It's great seeing shows on the lawn there.
Yeah, that was my first time there. The place is beautiful and
great.
It sounds amazing.
So great,
their sound system is amazing there, too.
For sure. What does ChatGPT have next for me?
Let's see. What's one tool behind the bar that you cannot live without?
I mean, I think everything back there is kind of necessary, but I'm trying to think of like what's the most necessary. I don't know. I mean, I'm obsessed with having like a really sharp, like petty or paring knife for cutting citrus. Like I'm like really fastidious about a lot of things, but like if we're cutting like lemon wedges or lemon wheels, like I want a laser sharp knife so that all of them look perfect. Like it's an attention to detail thing.
Yeah.
And so many bars you go into and they've been using like the same dull knife for like years. And like,
it's also dangerous to use a dull knife.
It is. Yeah. And but like, yeah, I mean, I have a couple of them and, I have like 1 6-inch Japanese, petty knife that I really like and make sure I keep it sharp all the time. And
do you sharpen it yourself or you take it somewhere?
No, I'm not good at it. I take it to Edgeworks.
Same. I, that I love knives. I've got way more than any human being needs, but I cannot sharpen one to save my life.
Yeah, I think that I couldn't live without probably all the necessary tools I have, but the most overlooked one, I think, would be a sharp knife for cutting garnishes.
What style of jigger do you prefer?
It's called a Leopold jigger. So it looks like there's two little bells. So there's like a smaller bell.
I like that one better too.
And the main reason is, well, one, I've been using it for like 10 years. And two, it's easy to like flip between your index and middle and your middle and your ring finger. So without having to do much, you can just flip to the big side or flip to the small side. They're not as accurate as like the more like kind of slender Japanese ones.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But I don't care. They're just so much more comfortable for me. And then
they just don't make them as accurately, or
I think it's just the design's not as accurate as like the conical, more slender shape. But I think if you're careful and you hold your hand really level with the Leopold jiggers, you're pretty close. And then the most overlooked one, I'd like recommend this to everyone, are the little OXO 3-ounce measuring cups. So they're great at home, like just if you're making gin and tonics and you want to like keep yourself in check, because you can just measure 2 ounces and you're like... Because that's the problem with home bartending. Like during COVID, we were all pouring like 6 ounce like whiskey gingers and stuff.
So that was one of the things I also used in my 20-year Pappy old fashioned videos. Yeah. And that was one of the things that people made fun of me a lot for using.
They are so wrong. Those little ox. And also
it was,
here's another huge advantage of those is, you know, we do 2 ounce pours for straight spirits, and I'll always use that to measure out a pour for people. Because 2 ounces in the jigger, like, you know, you need to like immediately pour it into the glass and you might spill some. So those just pour really nicely into like the kind of Glencairn style whiskey glasses we have. And
you know what those are really bad for though? Hmm. Espresso shots.
Or like, because it stains it? Or
no, you burn the hell out of your hand. Your finger. Oh, like, with the metal, you don't burn yourself, but...
The metal ones?
Yeah. Yeah, because I bought one of the metal ones, and I couldn't find my espresso, whatever they call the little cups, and I used that instead, like just mindlessly not thinking about how I was just about to grab a metal thing that had really hot liquid poured into it.
We actually cool down our espresso, so we have a cafe, the Acorn Provisions in Wyoke, and we thankfully the baristas do this for us. But you know, every day we start off on a weekday with like a whole quart of espresso, to like the weekends where like we've got like half a gallon of espresso like pre-pulled from there.
All right, what else do they have? What spirits or ingredients do you find yourself reaching for the most often?
There's definitely an answer to this. There's one. I use Benedictine a lot. Are you familiar with that? So you may have seen like the bottle where it's like B&B or something, like Benedictine and brandy, but it's...
It sounds from it. Let me look that up. I bet.
Benedictine. Yeah, if you see the bottle, it's like one of my absolute favorite ingredients for like kind of boozy stirred like dark spirit drinks.
Oh yeah, I've definitely seen that.
Yeah, it's got like kind of a slightly herbal honey like kind of spice flavor to it. I use that a whole lot. I always really liked Punta Mace. Have you had that before? It's basically a vermouth. Like Punta Mace means like point and
probably
a half.
Would have made much more sense to me to just say no instead of shaking my head, because one could hear that. See,
so yeah, I mean, it's made by Carpano, the same people who make like Carpano Antica, but the best way to describe it is like it's a more bitter vermouth, and it's got this really, really delicious kind of raisiny flavor to it, like bitter raisin.
How do you handle customers who don't know what they want to drink?
I mean, I always try and be really kind about it. And I have this kind of like system of questions that kind of narrows it down really fast. So I'll be like, first I'll be like, okay, do you have a favorite spirit? And they'll be like, ah, I really like gin. And then I'll be like, are you looking for something like more refreshing and light? Are you looking for something, you know, a little stronger, something to sip on? I try and avoid the word boozy. But that's what I mean by that question. And then if they're like, you know, I want something light and refreshing, and I'll be like, okay, do you like more like fruity flavors? Like, do you like, you know, citrus or like berries or something like that? Or do you like more herbal flavors? And then we can narrow it down. You know what I mean? Like, we can quickly arrive to like a last word or a corpse survivor number two or a gimlet. And like, you know, if people don't know what they want, it's my job to like help them figure it out. I mean, we got a whole menu, but
yeah,
I'll happily make anything off the menu that I have the ingredients for.
What are cocktail trends you are excited about right now?
I don't really know. I mean, it's been a while since I've been to like a cool cocktail bar in a city. I don't really know what like the up and up trend is at the moment. There are ones that I would like to go away, but
that's the follow-up question. Are there any trends you wish would disappear?
I know the espresso martini is here to stay, but I think it should be like the last thing you drink. Like, it's kind of a dessert drink.
Okay. Cause it'll destroy your palate or
just I mean, it's just like, they're usually on the sweeter side. I just don't get it. I don't get going out and having like five of them in a row.
Okay.
I feel like that kind of espresso martini drinking is just like Four Loko, but grown up. You know what I mean? Like trying to get caffeine buzz plus like the booze drunk. It is a drink that like I think is best had at the end of a meal with your dessert or something. Or it's like the last drink you have after like a couple at a night out.
One of our
It's not something you just pound like four of them. That's insane. Also weird when people drink more than one egg white drink. Sorry.
Is aquafaba just a replacement for egg whites?
Yeah, I mean, it'll produce like a foam on cocktail. But I think it's whoever came up with aquafaba is a genius because it's just like gooey chickpea juice.
Yeah, and it smells awful.
Oh, yeah, I mean,
like on its own.
Yeah.
It doesn't really make the cocktail smell any different.
No, but even with egg white cocktails, that, you know, it kind of has like a wet dog scent. That's why I'll always either put like bitters on something, spritz it with something, okay, do like a citrus peel over top.
One of our mutual friends, once while we were on a road trip, filled a Gatorade bottle with Four Loko and drank it.
Is it the OG Four Loko?
No, it was reformulated, but it still wrecked him.
When I was in, like, my college days were, like, the heyday of OG Four Loko and, like, kids getting sent to the hospital.
It's amazing that was... It had a short time span. They reacted to that pretty quickly. I think
it had to have been, like, on the market for maybe just like 2 years.
Yeah, it was not long. And then all hell broke loose.
And it was like 15% alcohol and it had like hundreds of milligrams of caffeine in it.
Yeah, it was an ungodly amount of both.
Yeah, but what a time to be a college student though. Like if that came out now, I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
But, but as a college student, sounds like the best idea like, possible.
Yeah, exactly.
What's one mistake you see home bartenders make all the time?
I don't know. I mean, I don't really like, I can't remember the last time I was at someone's house and they made me a cocktail.
All right. But
I can say that you do need to refrigerate your vermouth. Okay. That's the biggest one. Like if I go to someone's house and like the dry vermouth or sweet vermouth is opening on their counter, I'm like, put it in the fridge.
All right, then what is a mistake that you just see when you're out bartenders making?
There's like so many. Really. It'll be like, you know, kind of half-assed shaking the drink, not shaking it hard enough, or sloppy measuring, stuff like that. There's more like pet peeves I have. With like back bars, like I'm like always crazy about making sure my back bar is like perfectly straight and there's some sort of sense of organization to it. It's like we got scotches here and this there. When it's like really haphazard and just... It's like, you know, everyone who sits at a bar, like one of the things you do is you just kind of instinctively stare at bottles.
Yeah.
Like it's, I don't know why we do it, but we all do it. And like the nicer that looks, the better that experience is. So when I sit down in a bar and everything's just kind of loosey goosey thrown around everywhere, then I'm just like, you know, it just irks me. Or speed pours on bottles that are on the back bar. I don't like that either.
Why?
Just because it just doesn't look good.
Okay. So it's more of an aesthetic thing, not...
Yeah,
that
speed pours like, are for your stuff that's in the well.
Okay. But it doesn't, like functionally, it doesn't do anything. It's just from an aesthetic reason.
Yeah, okay. I don't know. Here's one that really bugged me. I was in DC. I was ordering a martini. The guy's stirring it in a pint glass, and he just keeps going and going and going. And, you know, part of like getting a martini right is using the right amount of glass, stirring until it gets to the right temperature, and then not over diluting it. So he was just like strike out on all three accounts. And then he just lets it sit in there in his pint glass that he used to mix it for like a solid minute before he strains it into the martini glass. And like this thing tasted like it was like 40% water. And yeah, that was the last time I remember like really being irked by a cocktail I ordered.
Do you just want to be like, can I teach you how to do this?
No, it is not my place to ever tell anyone else how to do something. I only proffer up, you know, advice when asked.
What role do cocktails play in storytelling or culture in your view?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's it. As soon as I started that, I was halfway through that. And I was like, I don't know.
I do think martinis are like very interesting culturally, especially like during like, you know, the mid 20th century, you know, like three martini lunches and, you know, guys making martinis for house guests at like parties. I feel like that was probably a cool time.
Have you noticed a shift in how people approach drinking in the last few years?
I definitely think more people are looking for like more non-alcoholic options. I think that's a trend that's here to stay.
Do you do mocktails?
We do. Yeah, we have like we'll have like one featured mocktail. We do the bottled Phony Negroni from St. Agrestis, which are pretty tasty, and then.
Is it still called a mocktail if it's NA spirits? Or is there a different? Okay.
I've still never had an NA spirit that I thought was good. They can mix well, but on their own they kind of taste like soap. So there's that. But
what's your go-to drink to make and your go-to drink to drink?
I really do not make a lot of drinks at home. Usually it'll be like a whiskey neat or whiskey on the rocks, but the furthest I'll go at home is making a martini, and then usually like the most, you know, like a Negroni maybe. I hate like trying to make juice at home or making syrups at home. Like it's so much easier in a restaurant. You've got like a professional juicer and unlimited ice. Like I don't have an ice machine in my refrigerator, so okay. I've still got like the old school like
twist and pop out.
So you got to keep up on that. And if you have friends over, like, you know, that's not enough ice for like, you know, multiple rounds of drinks.
Oh, that's a, so shaken drinks. What type of ice should be used in that?
As big as possible, okay. Really. But the problem is that, like at restaurants, the cold draft machines, they make like the best cubes for shaken cocktails, but they break all the time. I remember there was like a class one time that I wanted to take where it was just like cold draft repair class for bartenders. I didn't take it, but. Now we kind of like have a middle ground where we have like not tiny like chip ice, but at the restaurant we have like slightly bigger cubes.
So would like what's made in a nice maker at home, like that size, you mean by big? Or
I think as like a home bartender that would work.
Okay.
But really, it's not about the ice. It's about, like, the technique. Like, the nice thing about the cold draft cubes is it lets you shake for a longer amount of time, which means that since the ice is bigger, you get less dilution and you can get the drink colder. But with the smaller ices, you want to shake for less amount of time because it's going to dilute faster.
Okay.
So for the shaking and stirring, you kind of have to assess what you're working with and adjust how long you shake and stir according to how big the ice is. Bigger the ice, longer the stir, longer the shake. Smaller the ice, shorter the stir, shorter shake.
But then that will also affect like how the drink turns out too, right? At least especially for shaking.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of an imperfect science, but like they're like,
you'll do more damage to the cocktail with small ice shaking longer than.
Yeah. I mean, there are people who get really nerdy about it, but I've just done it for so long that like, I'll just look at what ice I have and I'll be, as I shake it, I know when it's done or stirring it. Like I can just tell when it's done.
Do you have a signature cocktail that you're known for?
I don't know. I mean, right now I think it's that Mirepoix Martini because, I mean, that one got mentioned in the Washington Post, which was awesome.
Okay.
Even though they didn't say my name, but whatever. I'm not saying Tom Seitzma is a jerk. I'm lucky that he mentioned the cocktail in the review.
How do you feel about reviewers?
Like professional reviewers that work for newspapers, I think they're great.
Okay.
The other ones, I don't. But here's the thing is like, none of my friends or anyone I know, I feel like are the kind of people that would take the time out of their life to go on, Yelp or Open Table and write a review.
Well, even though I have a platform too, I don't review things. I don't think I have the palate to be able to judge someone's work.
Yeah. And I mean,
like I'll say, something's made the way I like it, but like, I don't do reviews ever.
Like I just think like, if you want to know if you should go eat somewhere or drink somewhere, you should listen to a professional review over just some person on the internet.
So you don't think Reddit's a good source of...
Frederick Reddit is wild,
yeah,
man.
It is.
It is so opinionated.
And often just... some opinions are wrong. And there's a lot of wrong opinions on...
I do not want to get into Frederick Reddit.
The Frederick subreddit. But it's very entertaining.
I mean, I do. Like I hate reading reviews sometimes. And it is important, like, you know, sometimes you really do have to take these things seriously, like...
Well, because sometimes the, like, legitimate problems can be pointed out.
Yeah, but I always hope that those get pointed out when they happen at the
and
restaurant.
They should be,
like,
yeah,
it always sucks. Directly it always sucks when someone doesn't tell you right then and there that they're not happy. Because, like, if they tell you right then and there, like, we'll do everything we can to fix it. Like, you don't like it? Like, we don't care.
Yeah,
we'll get you something you do like.
Or well, no, like you do care. So
yeah,
you'll
just
you'll
like,
make
please
it
tell
good.
Like if you're out there listening, you don't like something, you're not happy. Just tell someone at the at the restaurant you're at. Like, don't wait until you're at home to like get mad about it. Because at that point, you know, I want people to give us a chance to fix things instead of, you know.
Yeah, because like people are humans and mistakes happen, especially if it's busy. Like it's not like you're neglectful or thing. Like you just
and if like people are like unhappy with like a drink that they ordered, like I don't care. Like I'm sorry you didn't like it. I'll make you something else.
Yeah,
but I'd rather you tell me than like suffer through something that you like. You ordered like a martini and it's like really strong. Like I don't want you to like if that's not your thing. Like let me make you something like fruity and delicious.
That will make you happy.
Yeah, exactly.
I would say ChatGPT didn't do half bad. It was my first time trying that.
Oh, so yeah. I was the guinea pig.
Yeah. Now it has a category named Rapid Fire Round that's fun and quick.
Okay.
So I think we'll end on this note. Although first we'll just say we've already said where your where you can be found.
Yeah, White Oak Tavern at Visitation Hotel.
Which is an absolutely phenomenal place. The food and cocktails are amazing. The atmosphere is awesome. It's an old... It was a church right?
It was a Catholic girls boarding school, and then the chapel was where they would receive mass.
Okay. And that's where the bar is. It looks awesome. Yeah, people get all worked up in their feels, but
maybe for like a month.
Yeah, now people seem to be over it now. Yeah. But I will contend if the Catholic Church cared about it, they would have removed everything.
Or like really at the end of the day, like I think it's great that you have the history of the building preserved instead of like, you know, it could have been torn down. That would have been way worse.
Yeah. So but the facility itself is beautiful and everything there is amazing. So I urge people to go check it out. So now let's do the rapid fire ones. I think you already know the answer to this one. Shaken or stirred?
Well, it depends, but we gave all the reasons earlier for what to shake and what to stir.
Whiskey or gin?
That's tough, but as much as I love gin, I go to whiskey more.
Negroni or old fashioned?
Negroni.
Favorite bar in the world?
I hope it still exists, but I like briefly lived in Worcester before I went to live in Boston for a little bit, and there was this dive bar there called Vincent's, and there's just like amazing blues players there all the time. All the bartenders wore bow ties for some reason, and there was just like taxidermied animals everywhere, and the only food they served was Parmesan subs. this was the best bar I've ever been to. Huh. And it was just like a dive bar.
But. Yeah. I went to one in Denver called the Yacht Club.
Oh, yeah.
And they made really good drinks, and their thing is hot dogs.
Yeah, love it.
Like if you go on their Instagram account, it's all pictures of cocktails and hot dogs. I'm not sure what this is, but dream collaboration, dead or alive.
Like a bartender?
I guess, yeah. Or like a...
I mean, I haven't been back to Boston in a long time, but I'd love to like make drinks again with one of my old mentors, Sam, who worked at this back bar I worked at there.
All right, that was a lame one to end on, but there are no other listed ones. Oh, well.
Oh, well.
Thank you so much for your time today. I definitely love learning about cocktails because there's so much I don't know. I bought a bunch of books, but like every other book I bought, they're just sitting on my bookshelf mocking me for not reading them yet.
Yeah, but also it's one of those things where like I think the best place to learn is at a bar. With like a bartender that you have a good rapport with, and like, you know, I'll make you some more martinis and stuff.
I like reading like the theory and history of things too.
When you read it, you're always just like, well, I want to taste it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you're right. It's probably just better to talk to you.
Yeah, it's like a cookbook. You're like, I want to make it now.
Yeah. So thank you so much for your time today, and thank you everyone for listening. Cheers.
All right. Cheers.
The Uncapped Podcast is produced by Graham Cullen and me, Chris Sands. Be sure to like us on Facebook, and if you've enjoyed these podcasts, please leave us a review on Google Play or the iTunes Store. A special thanks to Double Motorcycle for providing our theme music. Thanks for listening.
Oh my God, that's good.